Okay, we're going to go ahead and get started. My name is Justin Senior. I'm the Deputy Secretary for Medicaid at the Agency for Healthcare Administration. Welcome all to the Medical Care Advisory Committee meeting. And with that, I would ask that Carla call the roll.
Good afternoon. Cheryl Young with the Department of Health. Jerry Cully with the Department of Children and Families. Madeline Nobles with Department of Elder Affairs.
Present.
Crystal Stickle with Florida Hospital Association.
Present.
Amy Guinan-Liam with Florida Legal Services.
Present.
Ann Swirlick with CHAIN. Dr. Kathy Moffitt.
Present.
Florida Association of Health Plans. Dr. Thacker. Casey Stademeyer for Dr. Payne.
Present.
Stan Whitaker. And on the phone we have Martha Pierce and Michael Lockwood.
All right, welcome all. We have a fairly busy agenda here today involving some public meetings that we're required to do based on new federal regulations and a report to you that is the product of some new federal regulations involving our fee-for-service population. But I also wanted to give, as first thing on the agenda, a quick update of some of the waivers that we have in our program and that we're applying for with the federal government or adjusting with our federal government. First thing, our waiver, our 1915 BC combination waiver, which is the waiver that we use to get the authority from the federal government for our long-term services and supports managed care program, managed long-term care. That waiver was actually due to expire. I think it expired on June the 30th of 2016. There's been a temporary extension granted to that. We have submitted a renewal for that waiver, and we have a temporary extension until September 30th of 2016 while we finalize negotiations with the federal government for an extension of that waiver. Overall, that waiver, in terms of its performance, seems to us to have done a lot of the things that we were planning on it doing and hoping that it would do when we designed it. First off, we are seeing all of the plans generally shifting their populations from nursing facility settings and into home and community-based settings. And they're doing that in accordance with the way we've designed the fee structure in that program. We're also seeing very high consumer satisfaction with that program. It's sometimes hard to assess quality in long-term care because it's not really a medical service that's being delivered. It's chore work, it's home modifications, things like that. But the consumer satisfaction with the program appears to be very high, and so we are happy with that, and we do believe that we should be able to bring a renewal in for a landing for another few years. We have another waiver, a 1915 waiver for non-emergency transportation that is going to expire on December 31st of this year, and we have a renewal request that we intend to submit to the federal government that should be in on time on or before September 30th of 2016. As far as what we call our big waiver, our 1115 waiver, which is the authority that we have with the federal government, an agreement with them that allows us to run our statewide managed medical assistance program, that waiver is scheduled to expire on June 30th of 2017, so a little less than a year from now. We will be submitting a number of amendments to that waiver for this particular year, but also we will be submitting a renewal for that waiver that we will submit in December of this year. In order to continue that. And there will be public meetings, including a public meeting here using the Medical Care Advisory Committee, about that waiver before we do the renewal. As far as some of the amendments that we're going to do, in the past legislative session, we had the legislature pass a statute that calls for us to create a program for adding housing assistance for people with significant mental illnesses to the program. And we are starting a pilot and are going to be adding that as a service in regions 5 and 7. There's enough funding to do it in 2 regions. We're hopeful that we'll be able to expand it to additional regions if it proves to be effective, and we have we're very optimistic about that going forward. So we will be amending the 1115 waiver to try to expand those services to people in the St. Petersburg area and in the Orlando area. That's region 5 and 7. When it comes to the waiver extension, we probably will have dates or there will be a public notice period that will run from October 11th to November the 10th. There's a big process around a renewal. People will have the opportunity to submit public comments to the state prior to the renewal submission. After the renewal application is submitted, there will be an opportunity for people to submit comments and data and input to the federal government. And in the meantime, we will hold multiple public meetings. I think the federal regulations call for us to conduct two in at least two geographic areas of the state. We try to do more than that, so we will have at least three, and we will probably hold them in Miami, Tampa, as well as Tallahassee, and we may have more than one in Tallahassee. So we'll see how that goes, but we will try to do more than is required of us under federal law. Any before I go on to the access report, any questions about any of the waivers? Okay. So let me Amy, you're recognized.
Actually, Justin, sorry, just to follow up a little bit on the housing waiver amendment waiver that you're requesting.
Yes.
We actually just talked about it kind of in detail in the behavioral health subcommittee, and we had some questions or a little concern about the timing of how quickly the federal government will be able to approve those, and I know I'm kind of asking you to guess because there really isn't a specific time that they have to come back with it, right? But I guess our concern was it would be great to get it approved and running before the next legislative session so there's some information to report back on how it's doing.
That's Amy Guinan from Florida Legal Services for those who are on the phone, Amy Guinan Leem. We share that concern. We'd like to get it up and running as quickly as we can, and we will talk to our federal partners about that. I don't think this is the type of thing that they would like to throw roadblocks in front of us on. I think that they would like us to get it out quickly. Ordinarily, we can't implement something in an 1115 waiver until we actually have permission to do it. But at the same time, we might be able to have a conversation with them about perhaps making an exception to that in this case, knowing that almost certainly there will be approval eventually on this, because it really is not it's really something that I think everybody agrees is an exciting feature, something that can really be value added for these regions. And not only would we like ultimately to add it for these regions, I think the legislature was indicating that they would like to add it statewide. And I don't think there's any disagreement on that at this point. So we're hopeful of getting it done sooner rather than later. Okay. All right. Moving on to the access report. The official name is the Access Monitoring Review Plan, and this is something that, let me see if I can get it. The federal government has been recently enacting a number of regulations associated with the Medicaid program. They have put out a major regulation that deals with Medicaid managed care programs, though it would apply to our MMA program. They also have put out something called the Access Regulation, which deals specifically with fee-for-service populations in state Medicaid programs. As you can see from the slide, this access plan only applies to fee-for-service populations, and it excludes managed care populations. Important to know that the managed care rule itself does have access standards in it, so we do have to comply with respect to our statewide Medicaid managed care program with the access standards in the new managed care rule, and this access rule only applies to fee-for-service. Because of that, we're in a kind of a strange place in the state of Florida, where we have shifted our program from one that was predominantly fee-for-service several years ago to one that is now almost entirely managed care. And you'll see in the numbers as we go through the report how significant managed care penetration is in the state and how small the population is that truly receives their Medicaid services through the Medicaid fee-for-service program. Creates a lot of issues. Traditionally, for example, in our managed care program, we look at provider ratios to determine access. It's one of a number of different elements that we look at. Those no longer make any sense with respect to our fee-for-service population, and I'll give you a reason why. We actually have, let's say, 40,000, I believe it is about 40,000 doctors who are in our program, and they're enrolled fully in our program, able to provide fee-for-service services. They're enrolled in our program fully because we used to have a fee-for-service program, and we didn't have statewide Medicaid managed care. And now we have, and you'll see, fewer than 10,000 people that truly receive their Medicaid services on an ongoing basis from the fee-for-service Medicaid system, and it raises a ratio of, well, there are actually 8 doctors for every individual recipient. The numbers end up being skewed, the ratios don't mean much, and it's hard to tell what they mean for access in the state of Florida as we start to look at provider types. So we're kind of caught in the middle there. We also have a number of populations in fee-for-service And you'll see as I go through the report where it is very difficult to really assess access and whether payment levels are really associated with access. That becomes really difficult, in particular with medically needy, and it becomes particularly difficult with respect to the way that we do eligibility and enrollment in the state. And you'll see that as we go through the slides. Now, the rule does call for us to look at the access and the accessibility of a number of different provider types. They're listed here. We're looking at primary care physicians. We're looking at dental care. We're looking at FQHCs and county health departments. And then we're looking at a variety of different specialists as well as obstetricians, home health care. That's all specified and laid out in the rule. The report has to be done every 3 years, and our first report is going to be due on October the 1st of 2016. We do anticipate submitting it on time. The rule does require a public meeting, and the report has to be made for available for public comment, and we have done that, and we'll do that. And so we do welcome everybody's input on this and a discussion on this. We also are required, and that's why I'm here today, to develop the report and share the report with the Medical Care Advisory Committee so that the committee itself can give some input into the report. All right, you are going to see in a few moments just how small our fee-for-service population is. Most of our recipients are enrolled in statewide Medicaid managed care, and or they're enrolled in a waiver program that makes them exempt from the access monitoring report. If you look at it here, it's kind of small type, and I apologize for that. But this is really what you see if you look at our program as a snapshot in time. We serve just under 4 million people in the program. At any given time, you'll see on this chart reflects it just right around 3.9 million people. And you'll see where they are in terms of whether they're supposed to be part of this report, whether they really should be part of this report, or whether they are not. And we've divided it into three different categories, which I'll get into, which is here are the folks that are exempted from this report, people like statewide Medicaid managed care and people in waiver programs. These are the populations that are included in the report, but for a variety of reasons that I will get into, the access report makes no sense and doesn't give any sensible information about access for these individuals as we look at it. And so we are talking with the federal government about whether we should have to continue to report on some of these populations and whether or not they have quote-unquote access. And finally, we've got a couple of populations that we agree with the federal government definitely should be included in the report. These are people, by and large, that are not in waiver programs, not in managed care, so not excluded, but that also receive Medicaid services, and Medicaid is the entity that provides them health care coverage, and they would expect to have ongoing access to health and health care services and supplies through the Medicaid program and not through anyone else. And those folks, we would agree, definitely should be subject to the access report. All right. The folks that are omitted, these are omitted by rule. And you can see the percentages here of our population, and you can look at the numbers if you want to look at the prior page chart. But nearly 80% of our enrollees are in a statewide Medicaid managed care program. And so really the network adequacy requirements and the access requirements are in the managed care rule, and we follow that. They're not in the access rule. That only applies to fee-for-service. There are also a number of people who are partial dual eligible enrollees. What that means is that they are eligible for both Medicare and Medicaid, and their income levels are such that they are not eligible for Medicaid services from us. So when you think about the dentists and you think of, which isn't covered under Medicare anyway, but when you think about the primary care physicians, the obstetricians, you think about the specialists, the physicians that we provide access to for the Medicaid population, these individuals actually receive all of those services from the Medicare program, and all we pay are co-pays and help them with premiums. So there are no services associated, and they are omitted from the access report by rule. The last here is the folks that are in waivers. The folks in waiver programs are omitted from it. The waiver itself will specify the access requirements for those populations. Now, and I'll get into the arguments why. When you add up the people from the preceding page, you'll see that that adds up to, over 90% of the population of the program is omitted. But as you get into the next slide, you'll see that there are a number of populations that we think access and payment and access and ratio looks really don't make any sense at all. And they make up another almost 8%. of our population. That includes our newly eligible population, the people that come into our program from DCF and then are enrolled in a managed care plan. This involves our medically needy and emergency medical assistance for alien enrollees, and it includes a number of enrollees like refugees who are voluntary for the MMA program, and we'll get into a little bit more detail. Now, I do have an explanation as to why we think they should be omitted. When it comes to newly eligible mandatory MMA enrollees, someone comes into, let's say, a healthcare provider and they receive some services, and at the same time they submit an application to become eligible for the Medicaid program. DCF maybe takes a few days to act on that application, and they find the person to be eligible. On the day that they find the person to be eligible, sometimes it's the next day, but it's often the same day, they are enrolled in a managed care plan, and the access rule no longer applies to them. The payments that we make on a fee-for-service basis for this population are because on the day that they are determined eligible for DCF by DCF and go into managed care, they might be determined eligible for a date in the past. So it's a retroactive eligibility determination, and then any health care services that they received in that retroactive period, we will step in and pay. Again, we are not providing ongoing access to medical services for these individuals, and in fact, at the time that they accessed fee-for-service services, they weren't even eligible for Medicaid or known to be eligible for the Medicaid program. And so we've been talking to the federal government about how difficult this is to use the access report for anything meaningful when really what you're paying for here are payments for people who have been retroactively determined eligible. But on an ongoing basis, in terms of planning for their health care, once they're determined eligible, they're in a managed care plan. And the managed care plan is subject to very strict access requirements in terms of network adequacy. And that is really the rule that should apply to these populations. And that's actually quite a significant portion of our population, about 5% of our population. The next is the medically needy program. And this really has to do with the fact that the medically needy program is a safety net. It is not something that is designed to provide ongoing access to medical services. These are people that are generally above the income and asset thresholds for eligibility for the Medicaid program. And what happens to them is they have, let's say, a car accident or some sort of health crisis that results in them going into the emergency room, going into an inpatient admission. They incur a bill. That bill, then, if they paid it, would throw them below our income and eligibility thresholds, and we will step in then and recognize them as a medically needy recipient, and we pay the bill after the fact. They are only eligible from the day that they, during a month that they incurred the bill until the end of that month. Again, it's not supposed to be a coordinated, it's a safety net program that picks people up after the fact, after they've had access. And again, at the time that they've had access, they generally are not going to be Medicaid eligible. They establish their eligibility after the bill comes in. Once again, an access rule doesn't really fit well with this, and we've been talking with our federal partner about also this population is not one that should be part of this report. We are not trying to provide access to ongoing medical services and medical supplies for this population. And in addition to that, by definition with medically needy, access has already occurred. If you didn't have access, you couldn't possibly establish your eligibility for the medically needy program. And it generally happens at the hospital or a very expensive pharmaceutical expense, often a one-time thing. The next one, this one is also, we think, fairly intuitive. If you are not documented and in the country, you are only eligible for services in the emergency room. That is all you are eligible for. Once your emergency has passed, you are no longer eligible for services. The emergency room is required to treat you under federal law, and developing a chart about how many pediatricians, for example, see aliens doesn't make any sense. They are only eligible for services in the emergency room. And so we will continue our dialogue with the federal government about that. Finally, we also think that the population that is voluntary for the MMA program should be omitted from the report. these populations often live in an area that live in a setting or are in a setting where they get complete and comprehensive services like in an ICF ID, and so we don't believe that there are any access issues. But at the same time, for some reason, these populations have chosen to be in the fee-for-service setting as opposed to going into the managed care setting. So there must have some sort of relationship ongoing or some level of satisfaction with the services that they're receiving that would suggest that access is not an issue. These populations also are very small. In terms of folks in PPECs, for example, who are in fee-for-service, it's less than 1,000 people in the state. So even if they were included in the program or in the access report, it would be a very small population. Same with ICFDD. You're talking about fewer than 3,000, definitely. I think it's closer to 2,000. Amy Guinan-Leem, you are recognized from Florida Legal Services.
I just had a quick question. That number of 1,000 for the kids in PPEC, that was all of the kids in PPEC, just the voluntary ones in MMA?
I'll clarify. There are actually about 2,000 kids in PPEC. The majority of them have chosen to be in a managed care plan. Yeah, and so we're only talking about the ones that have decided, they've looked at being in a managed care plan and have decided instead to be in the fee-for-service product.
Gotcha. Thanks.
Okay. All right. The TPL population, we have a lot of acronyms in Medicaid, and TPL has got to be one of everybody's favorites, I'm sure. That's third-party liability. There are a lot of people out there. I think there's close to, 90,000, maybe 100,000 people in the state who are eligible for the statewide Medicaid managed care program, and they've established their eligibility for Medicaid, but they have chosen not to go in an MMA plan because they also have access to some sort of private insurance product that covers their health care services. These people have physician coverage, they have hospital coverage, they have health insurance, and because Medicaid is the payer of last resort, we are not paying for their ongoing health care needs. It's being paid for by a private insurance company. And so we don't believe, again, the access report makes much sense. We are not guaranteeing access for these individuals. We're not providing access for these individuals. They have a physician panel that is provided to them by their commercial health plan, and so we should not really include those individuals in the program. All right. That leaves about 5,500 people. And these are the folks that we definitely agree should be in. They're the presumptively eligible pregnant women, as well as women who become eligible by virtue of a diagnosis of breast or cervical cancer. They rely on us for their ongoing health care needs. They get it from the fee-for-service system, and it makes sense for us to monitor the access that these individuals have and to make sure that they're getting the services they need and when they need them. It's a very, very small population, and frankly, even if you put in some of the other populations where we pay for their services, like the medically needy, it's still, the fee-for-service population remains very small in the state. It's less than 10% of the population. As far as measuring access to care, one of the main ways that we do it, both in managed care as well as in fee-for-service, is we track complaints. And we look and categorize the complaints that come in, and we try to determine whether those complaints are related to access. And you'll see here that we had 7,124 fee-for-service complaints in our complaint system from April 1st, 2015 to March 31st, 2016, so a full calendar year. 46 of those were a complaint specific to whether or not someone was having trouble locating a doctor or specialist. This is looking at our entire fee-for-service population, not just the ones we agree should be in. It's a relatively low number, so it's not necessarily indicative of an enormous problem. But at the same time, we do handle all the complaints that we get. We take them seriously. We try to look for trends, and we try to spot problems before they become major conflagrations. The next up is we tried to do as best we could looking at some of the ratios that we had with our provider network. And as I mentioned before, some of these ratios, if we did them straight up, wouldn't make any sense. And it would look like we had more physicians, for example, than enrollees when it came to our fee-for-service population. And so we had to modify it a little bit to look at some of the provider counts and think about how we should evaluate whether or not there are enough physicians actually serving these recipients. And so here you go. Again, like I said, we did look at all of our fee-for-service recipients, all of the populations that CMS said we should look at, not We didn't exclude the ones that we don't think we should be looking at. We looked at all of them. And we started to come up with ratios to look at the network adequacy. And I'll tell you what we did here. Instead of just saying there are 41,000 docs and there's only 35,000 or 400,000, so it's 1 to 10, what we did is we looked at the total number of providers that were actually providing services to the fee-for-service population, as well as the total fee-for-service population, and then the total fee-for-service population that used the service during the course of the year. And what you see is that we have about 12,089 primary health care physicians who actually saw fee-for-service patients during the course of the year, and 45,000 patients that went to see a primary care physician. That is a provider-user ratio of one physician for every 3.73 persons, and in terms of the provider-recipient ratio of primary care physicians to the total number of fee-for-service, there is one primary care physician for every 37 recipients in that 400,000 or so fee-for-service population. And you can look at it by region, and you can look at the statewide total there. And that's something that we repeated as we looked at each of these particular the provider types that are covered or supposed to be covered under the access rule. You also see our spend there and the amount of money that we've spent per user per month, as well as the number of claims. And you'll see that for all of the provider types. Moving on to dentistry, you'll see that there were about 1,100 dentists providing services to the fee-for-service population around the state. They provided services to 4,251 recipients. That's one dentist for every 3.6 recipients who went to the dentist, and one dentist for every 407 recipients in the fee-for-service system. There's a reason why, I think it's fair to say, there's a reason why you'll see some of the numbers look off, and you'll see a lot of the recipients didn't access services. You can tell by looking at this that there's several hundred thousand people that did not access dental services, for example. A lot of that is because you wouldn't expect that to show up in the medically needy program, and you wouldn't expect someone in a retroactive eligibility period who's come into the program to try to set a dental appointment before they got into the program and became eligible. They then set up that through their health plan. So you'll see, again, difficulty making sense of the data because of the way the fee-for-service population is arrayed in the state of Florida. It's just not something that's easy to do. For what it's worth, these are within the ratios in terms of one dentist for every 407 recipients. It's within the ratios that we'd expect of our managed care plans, well within them. But again, I think it's very difficult to make sense of the number and to say whether it's good or bad given the size of the population. Same thing you'll see here. This is FQHCs, clinical health care, clinical services, FQHCs, and county health departments. You can look at the amount that we've spent. You can look at the ratios, and you can see one for every 25 users and one for every 1,081 recipients. And finally, specialists. There's one specialist providing services to the fee-for-service population for every 2.27 accessors of specialist services and one specialist for every 32 fee-for-service recipients. You'll see the same for behavioral health. You'll see the same for obstetrical services. And you'll see the same for home health services. Now, whether the ratios mean anything or not is very, very difficult to tell. But for what it is worth, they do appear to be within the ranges, well within the ranges in most instances of what we expect to expect from our managed care plans, and none of them are outside of that. One other thing that we have a lot of different tools that we would look at when it comes to the managed care plans, and one of the things that you look at when you're measuring access is access. Did people actually get the services? And we have these things called HEDIS scores where you can look at, well, you'd expect all of your kids that are in this plan to have received this many checkups during the course of the year, what percentage of them actually received it? And then you can compare that to the national average. One thing that we've seen, though, as we've gotten into our data, and we have our first full year of HEDIS scores that we're kind of looking at right now and finalizing in the statewide Medicaid managed care program, is that you have to have certain minimum numbers of people in your denominator. And as your plan gets smaller And we have a number of plans called specialty plans that often have 10,000 or 5,000 recipients. There are a lot more NAs in the HEDIS scores, not applicable. They didn't have enough people in the denominator to get a full score. And that's a big concern when you look at this fee-for-service population. How many people in the medically needy program would be eligible for 11 consecutive months so they could be in a HEDIS denominator for dental? The answer is probably zero. And you're not going to have enough numbers to actually drive a score to determine whether or not people are receiving the care that you'd expect them to receive. A lot of that is because they're not really accessing our program in a way where you'd expect them to have or receive ongoing care. They're accessing our program as part of a safety net or a one-off because they ordinarily wouldn't meet our income eligibility thresholds or because they've come into our program and they were found retroactively eligible, but they're really moving forward and need coordinated care from their managed care plan. We also tried to, for what it's worth, look at what the plans pay in the commercial arena versus what they pay in the Medicaid arena, and we were told that was trade secret and it was not shared with us. So... we did, however, as we've submitted the report to the federal government, you will see we've got links to our fee schedule as well as the Medicare fee schedule. That doesn't help the dentist, but for other different provider types, you can take a look and see how some of our payment rates compare. The 30-day public notice and comment period started on August the 22nd, and it ends on September the 22nd. We have posted this on our federal authorities webpage. You can see the link there, and you are able to send us comments via the mail. You can send them by email. You can send them by, pack mule, carrier pigeon, owl, however you want to send them, you can send them. And here's a little primer on where to send them and where to send your emails if you need them. But also, you can make a comment here to us today and give us your input and what you're thinking. We will prepare. We'll take into account the suggestions and comments that we get, and we will submit the report to CMS on or before October the 1st of 2016. Thereafter, it'll be a report that we update every 3 years. We are hopeful to get some leeway from the federal government. These are the first reports that everyone is getting around the country. I'm thinking they probably are going to get a lot of information around medically needy programs and retro-eligibility individuals that will probably help them decide that those people shouldn't be included in the report in the future, but we'll see. These are the first reports. I don't think they want to give any exceptions at the first stab. They wanted to see exactly what they could get out of this type of analysis before they made any decisions about what ongoing reporting would look like. With that, I will start the question slide. And we'll start with the committee members, and then we will seek input from the audience. Dr. Moffitt, you are recognized.
Justin, well, to the extent that you need consultation from the Medical Care Advisory Committee, thank you for the presentation. As one member of the committee, I wholeheartedly agree with all your caveats. I think you get an A for academic honesty on the study.
The numbers look fantastic.
Right.
They don't mean anything.
Right. But because of the population size,
yes,
it's apples to oranges.
Yeah.
And for anyone that the federal government or otherwise to infer anything about access would be a shame. And I think as a member of the committee, I'm going to be much more interested in longitudinal comparisons pre and post implementation of the MMA program in terms of outcomes. And provider recipient ratios in this study seem meaningless to me as a measure of access, at least in the measured population.
Sure.
So there's my input.
Thank you.
Sure.
Anyone else? Amy Guinan-Lean, you're recognized.
And I just want to echo Dr. Moffitt's praise. Great job putting this together, and I agree wholeheartedly with your recommendations for what are omitted. I mean, what should be omitted? There's so many reporting requirements that you're responsible forever, the plans are responsible for, everyone's responsible for, that are so important and crucial and will really give us some results and show us what we need to be doing. And so we shouldn't be wasting time. I guess that's a little harsh to say, but we shouldn't be using resources to something that's really not going to be effective. I did have a question, though, if you don't mind just going over it
one more time. That's why we're on the question slide.
I believe it was page 8, about the 5.2% of the newly eligible mandatory MMA enrollees. I understood the process now. It was basically what you were saying is that with the new express enrollment, most of those in the past when they were fee-for-service for the time if they didn't choose their plan. Now they're automatically going into a plan when they become eligible, except there's that retroactive group that you are paying fee-for-service. And so is that the 5.2% you were talking about?
Yeah, if you go back to the first slide, you'll see there's about 3.8 million people, 3.8 to 3.9 million people in any given month in our program. And 5.2% of those people in any given month are newly eligible mandatory MMA enrollees. So they will show up in data as being fee-for-service on the first of the month, right? But they became eligible for Medicaid on the 15th of the month, and they went into their managed care plan on the 15th.
Gotcha. Okay.
But we will pay claims going back sometimes even beyond the first of the month, because I think go back about 90 days, uh-huh, and pay some all of the fee-for-service claims that they had prior to the determination of their eligibility. Now, you're right. That is a relatively new feature. It's been going on for almost a year in our program. Before, you were determined eligible, and you'd have to wait till the first of the following month or even the first of the month after that if you came in very late in a month before you were enrolled in a plan. So you actually did have a fee-for-service time period where you were actively enrolled in fee-for-service, and if you wanted to try to make an appointment and get into an appointment, it would have to be done through the fee-for-service program. Mm-hmm. That no longer exists with express enrollment, so about 5% of the people that show up as being fee-for-service on the first of the month actually went into a managed care plan at some point during the month, and all of the findings about them were retroactive in terms of the fee-for-service paid claims.
Okay, gotcha. Okay. Thank you.
All right, let me go back to the question slide so people feel comfortable. There we go. Any additional comments or input from the committee itself?
I don't have any questions about the Department of Health supports your strategy as well.
Thank you, Ms. Young. Yeah, Cheryl Young from the department. Thank you. All right, with that, we'll open it to the floor then. If anybody thinks on the committee of additional questions you'd like to ask, or if something comes from the floor that raises additional questions, you're certainly welcome to come back at the end, and we'll make sure your questions are heard by the committee. Any questions from folks in our live studio audience?
It's Mr. Television.
Okay. On air. All right, seeing none, we will go on to the next. Oh, do we have any questions on the phone? Sorry about that.
You are all live. There are no questions at this moment.
Okay. Well, hearing none, if folks think of anything as the meeting progresses, you're welcome to ask of someone. I probably will be stepping out in a couple of minutes, but we will move on now to the subpopulation committee updates. Thanks all.
Heather Allman presenting on behavioral health. Or Charles.
Charles McGillen for Heather Allman with Medicaid policy. So we conducted the Behavioral Health Substance Use Disorder Population Committee. We did discuss the behavioral health coverage policies and the updated formats. We discussed the housing services waiver pilot. We had a few, as Amy indicated, we had a few questions that we're going to discuss and then, resolve later. And then we kind of discussed Senate Bill 12, the revenue maximization with DCF. And then we had proposed projects. We were discussing the specialty provider types for residential and freestanding psychiatric providers, discussing the subtypes for, I believe it was provider type 16, and then how that would assist behavioral health type entities providing services to Medicaid recipients. there any questions?
I have a question. On Senate Bill 12 with the Rev Max, what is sort of the discussion around that, or what are you guys looking at pursuing?
So the discussion, I mean, Heather would be better able to answer the question, but the discussion is generally around how, working with DCF, how we can better utilize, Beth.
Can jump in too. And I've not been in the details on it, but Senate Bill 12 for I'm Beth Kidder. I'm the Assistant Deputy Secretary for Medicaid Policy and Quality. And Senate Bill 12 is a huge bill, as I think anyone who's looked at it knows. So we have some specific pieces of it here at Medicaid, but really our partnership is with Department of Children and Families and the stakeholders. But there's a lot of different pieces of it, and what Chuck was talking about is there's a move to look at the services that we provide and determine whether we're providing or whether DCF is providing services that could be covered by Medicaid and then thereby drawing down federal dollars for those, federal match for that, rather than just state GR, and other ways to serve populations that perhaps are underserved or could be better served with different services. And then as another part of our effort, it's not directly related to Senate Bill 12, but rather part of our overall efforts to take a hard look at all of our coverage policies. We are doing some major work, I call it maybe a 20-year review of our coverage policies for behavioral health services, and really saying what is the state of the art in treatment of behavioral health and disorders. And so we're working with stakeholders on that and saying, you know, are some of these codes and some of the things we cover not really the best use of resources, that there are better evidence-based services. That's kind of the 10,000-foot view, but that is the dialogue that's going on, is really how do we make better use of the service, the revenue and the dollars that we have, and then how can we expand that pot more by drawing down federal dollars to be able to perhaps serve more people or serve them better or deeper. Am I missing anything major from our DCF partners or Amy?
Do you want to go ahead?
If I just to be a little bit more specific to Crystal's question about our discussion at the behavioral health meeting, one of the things that the committee was particularly interested in as part of SB 12 was the expanded collaboration required of managed care plans or the MMA plans and the managing entities providing behavioral health services for children. So I believe Chuck and Heather are going to check in to see if maybe we could have a joint meeting with the Children's Subcommittee to kind of follow up on issues that we've talked about.
The Healthcare Administration, your call is very important to us. Please.
Just a reminder to the folks on the phone to please not pick up another call while you're on it, because that will put us on hold, and that was obviously an ACA employee who did that, or put us on mute. Thank you. We will hear your hold messaging.
So I think we're going to continue that conversation. That's something I think our subcommittee is interested in and the children's subcommittee is. And I do just want to mention right now, I think if there are other issues that you have that maybe you think the committee would be looking at, I think that would be great for you to suggest, because Chuck and Heather have been wonderful about really helping the subcommittee discuss the issues and check that we're kind of taking the approach that we think that we should be. So I appreciate that from both of y'all. But if you do have behavioral health issues that you think the committee should be looking at, please join our subcommittee or, you know, suggest it to us so we can make sure to bring it up.
And so actually, I did forget to mention that we were going to collaborate with the children's subcommittee and then discuss different behavioral health type issues that collaborate with them.
Chuck, can I mention one other thing, just kind of add to that? This is David Rogers with Medicaid Operations. I don't know if it came up in the subcommittee, but in terms of collaboration between the health plans and the managing entities, we've just implemented, it's been a bit of a process and a long time coming, where we have Medicaid eligibility data, including health plan enrollment, flowing to the managing entities. Previously, although they could check Medicaid eligibility, somewhat difficult manner, could not access health plan enrollment information. So we've implemented that electronic data exchange, health information exchange with the directly from the agency to all the managing entities. So that will be a kind of necessary, groundwork for them to do the kind of coordination that you're talking about.
Any other questions?
Thanks, Jeff.
All right,
appreciate it.
Next is a subcommittee on children, including foster children, Lakira Reddick.
Good afternoon. I'm Lakira Reddick for the children, including safeguard and performance measures related to foster children. Recently, the subcommittee has appointed two new members, and some of the goals that we are working on include to provide feedback on the child health checkup letters. The language in the letters needs to be updated, so the subcommittee will assist in constructing new language. Goal two, to provide the subcommittee updates regarding the Medicaid coverage policies. Goal three, to increase membership and participation of this subcommittee, including representation from the Department of Juvenile Justice. Some of the current projects that we are working on include facilitating discussions and solutions related to preventing children from needing deeper and services, i.e. residential treatment services, post-adoption, facilitating discussions to better understand the role of the managing entities, as Chuck noted earlier, and coordinating to achieve more uniformity among the various managing entities, and handling staffing meetings, referrals, and Medicaid-funded services in coordination with health plans. Some of the proposed projects that we are currently working on, again, to send out draft copies of the child health checkup letters to all the subcommittee participants, to clearly define the managing entity roles, and of course we will work with the behavioral health subcommittee on this, and to have follow-up meetings to discuss any outside issues. Thank you.
Next is the Subcommittee for Dental Care for Children. Monique Johnson.
Hello, I'm Monique Johnson. I'm here on behalf of Erica Thomas. And our goals in the Dental Care for Children Subcommittee are to effectively communicate key information regarding the delivery of dental services, and to foster ongoing dialogue to receive insight and recommendations from our stakeholder groups. And our current projects that we reviewed today, we talked about our handbook adoption, our dental services coverage policy, and our oral maxillofacial surgery services coverage policy were effective May 5th of 2016, and are currently available on the Rules Unit site for promulgated rules. Our registered dental hygienist enrollment we're happy to announce that the systems work has been completed, and they are currently able to start enrolling on the website. They will be able to enroll as rendering providers without the supervision of a dentist when associated with a health access setting. The health access setting will be listed as the billing provider and will bill Florida Medicaid directly for the RDA services, where they will be listed as the rendering provider on the claim. We discussed our 416 submission, which was submitted April 1st of 2016 and has been accepted by CMS. According to the report, 31% of the children eligible children enrolled for 90 continuous days received a preventative dental service, which represents a 5% increase from last year. 139,641 children received a sealant on a permanent molar, representing an increase over last year's total of 102,599. The improvements are a result of key areas where we made improvements of collection of previously underreported data, increased collaboration with our help access settings, streamlining and updating data queries used to pull the report. We also discussed the closeout of our SOHAP, which closed out in May. It concluded a five-year project with CMS on the State Oral Health Action Plan. Through our work with the SOHAP, we were able to create a single streamlined query for CMS 416 data collection. The agency plans to sustain the work on the SOHAP by dedicating staff to an annual review of the 416 instructions, continuation of the 416 workgroup, a central repository for quick access by the workgroup participants, and possible contract amendments to reflect decisions made by the workgroup. The agency continues to work towards oral health goals by seeking to partner with Head Start and early Head Start centers to contract with the FQHCs and the CHGs to provide oral health services in those health access settings. And we discussed our newly released dental HEDIS score for calendar year 2015, which is up to 47% and represents a steady increase from 2010 from 34% up to the current 47%. And then Megan's going to go over our new initiatives and next steps.
Okay, can everyone hear me? Okay, hi, my name is Megan Weil, and I'm from the Bureau of Quality here at ACCA. I'm going to talk about a couple of initiatives that we've been working on. In terms of quality. One is what we call our PIP check-in process. And essentially what that means is we are checking in on one of the PIPs, which is a performance improvement project that all of our health plans are required to do, and that is the one related to preventive dental services for children. So what we've done is we've developed teams. We have four different teams in our quality bureau that have been assigned 3 to 4 health plans each. We've gone out into the field in the state and met with each health plan face-to-face and went through their preventive dental PIP with them, talking about and addressing prioritization and identification of barriers, evidence-based interventions, appropriate measuring. We've also linked them with important resources such as HSAG, which is our external quality review organization. So if they have any difficulty in completing their PIP with the measurement and the Plan Do Study Act process, we can link them with the appropriate technical assistance. We have completed one PIP check-in, and we are in the process of completing the second for the preventive dental PIP. And we're happy to say that so far it has been very effective, and we're happy to see that all of the health plans are considering our recommendations and implementing some of the interventions. They are contacting HSAG. They are utilizing those technical assistance appointments, and it's going well. The second project that I want to talk about is our new consumer engagement project. This kind of stemmed from what we discovered during the PIP check-ins, that there were several barriers to children accessing preventive dental benefits, all of which I'm sure we're all aware of in this room. So we decided we wanted to do something on our end from a quality standpoint. So we created a consumer-friendly webpage. And this webpage very clearly details what Medicaid covers for children for dental services, why oral health is important for children and babies, and it talks about how to find a dentist, transportation to the dentist, and then it also talks about how to report a problem, which we thought was a really important component. We included the complaint hub on there. We did attend the Oral Health Florida conference, and we have talked about this website in the as well as the campaign, which that's a social media campaign that links to the website. So essentially what we're doing is we're putting Facebook and Twitter messages out with oral health messages that are, again, consumer friendly. that talk about the preventive dental benefit, that talk about oral health care for children. The link is included with those messages, and it goes back to the website. We also, with the messages on the website, we created a new logo. And the logo is identifiable on all of our web materials, our print materials, anything that goes out related to this campaign. And it says Florida Medicaid Dental Care for Your Health, which sends the message that dental care is important for health reasons, not just cosmetic reasons. So we have the new campaign launch. We just started posting this week, so we're encouraging all of our stakeholders to help us spread the message. That's all I have. Any questions?
Great. Thank you, ladies. Next up is HIV/AIDS Subcommittee with Sophia Whaley.
Hi, good afternoon. My name is Sophia Whaley with the HIV/AIDS Subcommittee. The committee's goal is to improve health outcomes for individuals living with HIV and AIDS in Florida. Florida has been identified as leading in the new HIV/AIDS cases in the United States. So we have a major concern on how to address that. So we've been reviewing the health plan performance measures to look for opportunities for improvements. We know that we are using agency-defined measures right now, but we are still looking at other opportunities for improvement in our performance measures. We reviewed the approved algorithm for HIV/AIDS that was posted on the agency website as of March, and everyone was okay with the algorithm. We also are looking for continued ways to improve our HIV/AIDS outcomes. We have a major issue, not issue, I'm sorry, excuse me. We have, one of our committee members is really focused on the specialty plans pharmacy and how that information is distributed to the consumers. So we will be looking and discussing that toward our next meeting. And we are also looking at our Project CARE redesign. That's our waiver that serves individuals with AIDS. We have approximately 8,000 individuals currently on the waiver, so we are looking at ways to better serve and meet the needs of those individuals through other avenues as well. And our proposed project is to continue to review consumer information that goes out to the consumers related to HIV/AIDS with the focus on a specialty pharmacy. Thank you.
Thank you, Sophia. And last but not least is Managed Long-Term Care Subcommittee with Eunice Medina.
Save the best for last. Just kidding. All right, so some of the goals that we're covering, first, Eunice Medina, co-lead of the Long-Term Care Subcommittee. Some of the goals that we're covering in our group is building on performance for long-term care, and that has involved initially reviewing the plan performance improvement projects, but now that our group has expanded, we're moving more into the enrollee satisfaction survey results, looking at complaints on a monthly basis for long-term care and identifying trends and suggestions and sharing information with our group. Another goal has been focusing on the discussion of outcome measures. We're now that we have a larger group that has varying degrees of experience with long-term care, we're going to start looking at the contractual and the waiver performance measures and seeing if we can move them from more of a process to outcome-based measure. So any suggestions that the group can come up with, we'll share with our quality and sister agency and federal authorities unit here at the agency. And then aside from that, any other ways that we can find to improve the long-term care program and advise the agency, especially when it comes to our statewide Medicaid managed care quarterly reports, any ideas of areas that we can focus on, we'll share that with our quality bureau. We look at any monitoring results. As soon as we are ready to share that with the group, we'll start looking at those items and seeing any other recommendations. So aside from that, that pretty much covers it. All right, thank you.
Next on the agenda is a review of the medical care advisory bylaws. And the committee has looked at the bylaws and given their input, and we have just a few items that we need to discuss and vote on. The changes that were made to the bylaws, as you can see from your track change version, those of you on the committee, we changed the word past to former in Article 2, Section 1 of the bylaws, replacing past again with former. And then in Section 2 of that same article, we added a sentence stating that to assure current representation and consumer experience, membership by former beneficiaries or their representatives is limited to those who have received Medicaid benefits within the previous 2 years. Again, under Section 5, we added former beneficiaries. And then the only other change made to the bylaws is on Article 6, Section 1, where we identified that the bylaws could be amended by 2/3 simple majority of the membership of the committee. Are there any questions regarding the changes to the bylaws? A motion for accepting?
So moved.
Okay, we'll take a vote. All those in favor?
Aye.
Any opposed? We have 2/3 majority with those on the phone and those here in the present in the audience. So we are passing our bylaws, and it's been a long time coming. So thank you all. Next on the agenda is David Rogers.
Good afternoon. I'm David Rogers, the Assistant Deputy Secretary for Medicaid Operations. So I get to be the closer today. Okay. We're going to go over kind of an update on complaints and some compliance issues. So I'll point you to what you should be used to seeing now, our monthly complaint report that's in your package. I think before we dive into that, though, let me just give a little context around some trends. So fairly consistently, we see about a little more than half, about 52% of the complaints that the agency receives that come to us by way of the telephone through the Medicaid helpline. The other 48% roughly come through the online, the web-based form. Sometimes we get actual, U.S. mail, letters in the mail. That also counts in that 48%. I don't think we've got any complaint by OWL delivery yet, but we might have to start. Yeah, we might have to start classifying for that. We have about half roughly come from Medicaid beneficiaries, and about half come from Medicaid providers. It's a little bit different based on the program. Under the Managed Medical Assistance, it is slightly more, actually about 64% of the complaints are registered by beneficiaries themselves. And in the long-term care program, it's a little over 50% are actually registered by providers. So in the MMA program, majority of complaints from beneficiaries, and in the long-term care program, majority of complaints from providers, which, again, much kind of narrow provider group involved there. The MMA program does comprise 40%, if you look over the last few months, of the complaints received by the agency. Another 27%, we classify them as enrollment support, which I'll speak to in a little bit. But this is basically non-plan-specific complaints. If a beneficiary says I was enrolled in a plan and I, a managed care plan, a health plan, and I shouldn't be, might be a complaint, or I was enrolled in a health plan and it's not the one that that I selected, that'd be a complaint, or you know, my choice counsel that I spoke to was rude or not helpful or whatever the case, right? That's all in kind of the category of an enrollment support. That does include systems issues also. So if we have a less than up-to-date address that we receive from the Department of Children and Families who determines eligibility, that is not an uncommon occurrence. And we think you're in Walton County, and we enroll you in a health plan in Walton County, and you've actually moved to Bay County, that we classify that as enrollment support. We have a process that's, again, fairly routine for us to make those kind of changes coming through the complaint center. We actually do like beneficiaries to call us because we can often resolve that immediately on that call. And sometimes with provider issues, particularly billing issues, which we'll see get you know, a little bit more difficult, and the web form works very well in terms of providing that information. We do have about 24% of our complaints that are registered are from our remnant fee-for-service program. Justin alluded to that in the access, going through the access report. We began tracking those in early 2015, so after we had begun to develop the system for the statewide Medicaid managed care program. And about 8% of the complaints received are specific to the long-term care program. And I, those are, that were in the managed long-term care subcommittee, I think were provided, should look pretty familiar to you, a copy of a long-term care specific report. So I don't think we got a lot of time to deal with it in the subcommittee, but hopefully we'll get some feedback and you will start to see kind of a complement to the MMA version of the complaint report as a routine monthly report that we can share with you as well. Okay, so we will dive into to the MMA report for the Managed Medical Assistance Program. I think the first thing that I would point out, if you're very astute, you might have noticed there is a fairly significant formatting change in the report. So we, when we looked at median days of resolution, we've now, beginning this fiscal year, July, or this first report for the state fiscal year, are splitting out the resolution time for provider complaints for claims payment, provider payment-related complaints, and for non-payment-related complaints. What we were finding is there is a lot of complex, about a third, a little more than a third of our MMA complaints on a monthly basis are for services, you know, could be quality of services, you know, my ride was late to take me to the doctor, or, you know, or an actual denial. A little less than a third on a monthly basis are provider payment complaints, but we have only one category of complaints for that. And we were finding when we were tracking the resolution of the provider payment complaints with the other provider complaints that it really was skewing that measurement of how responsive the plans were to provider complaints, because they often take much longer on the provider payment side. And we did think it would be helpful to kind of highlight that. You can see some fairly significant variation in the mean resolution time on the provider complaint side. So that'll be an area of emphasis for us as we go forward in this fiscal year, and this is kind of an approach for us to kind of isolate out those provider payment issues in our ongoing reporting. We have, this may be overstated, we are in the process as we speak, really, of implementing some changes to our complaints tracking system. We have used a separate system for provider payment complaints than our general provider complaints or beneficiary complaints. And we've made some enhancements to that, which again should allow us to get more granular in the reporting of the provider complaint. So again, you'll see in these reports ongoing some continued focus on the provider payment side and hopefully some continued granularity. That is a little bit different setup in the report. We do have an overall increase in the number of complaints when we look back over the last couple months, really the last 3 months. We kind of look at it at trending over a rolling three-month period. It is driven largely by, as you can see at the bottom of this report, by the non-plan-specific issues. And those are classified on the detailed page as systems issues. This was really an issue of some data corruption in the flow of Medicare Advantage health plan information from our federal partners through our Florida Medicaid Management Information System and into our enrollment broker system. We do have, again, our contact center and phone lines equipped to kind of make those changes as they come up, but we had, I think in May, that it's a data issue that created a lot of unaligned assignments. You know, we're set up that we tried to, if you were enrolled in a specific health plan for Medicare Advantage, that we try to do to align you if you have the option to choose a plan, but if you don't make a plan selection, self-select a plan, we try to assign you to that affiliated Medicaid plan, right? So you have the same plan sponsor. With the corruption in the data, we were off in the alignment of some assignments really in June, which this July number is really a continuation of that particular scenario. A couple of other things when you look at the red stands out. These are just metrics that help us kind of focus. We do look at complaints really on a weekly basis. Our contract managers and working with our recipient provider assistance staff. So this is kind of a counter check to that highlights some areas for us. But you have to take the metrics with a little bit of caution. For example, it looks like the big movers here are down in the specialty plans on both the HIV plans. So when I say big movers, in clear over the past 3 months has gone up by one complaint per 1,000 enrollees, and positive health care has gone up by a half a complaint per 1,000 enrollees over that period. Well, for clear, that's going from about 8 complaints to about 12 complaints, right? And then with positive, because they have such a low enrollment, less than 2,000 beneficiaries enrolled in that plan, that's literally going from about 2 complaints a month to 3 complaints a month. So again, this kind of tells it gets our attention to look, but it requires us to look, and we do that on a weekly basis. On those, really the standard plans, probably you see United and Humana as probably the drivers there. And again, we're talking about a dozen complaints, either way, or increase probably for those two plans. We will kind of go to the details, and then I'll just kind of point out a couple of things here. There's the 514, the systems issues that I mentioned, again, are really around the Medicare Advantage enrollment and the MMA enrollment. Our network access that Justin mentioned, we are tracking on the fee-for-service side as well as the managed care side under the respective federal regulations. It's about the same amount. Proportionally, it's a little bit lower. It generally runs about 8% of our complaints for MMA or access-related issues. I think this is maybe close to 5%. I could do the math. It's a little lower proportionally, but that's because of a larger proportion of these systems issues that played out. And then the payment and the service issues are about on track. There's a bit of a spike on the service issues in service denials for Humana, and when I say a bit of a spike, this is really about five or six more complaints than they had the previous month. But those are the kind of things that, again, draw our attention. So I have not heard that we've identified any specific trend, but that's the kind of thing that the contract management staff would be working on with our recipient provider assistance folks. Okay. without pause for any questions, and then I wanted to pivot to some other things that we were doing in compliance.
On the network adequacy complaints where it talks about not enough providers of a specific type, do you have or is any correlation with what type of provider that is? Sure. It's Crystal Stickle with the Florida Hospital Association.
We do. We don't break it out in this report, but we can certainly figure out a way to do that on an ongoing basis. We do track by the provider type. So we have program and the what we call the issue category, a subcategory, and then for each of those a provider type. It's fairly easy for us to look at to do.
That would be great. Thank you.
Other questions? Okay. Amy? I was gonna say, I know you have some questions.
Well, Crystal's question actually got me thinking. Okay, so we know that they are these plans are required to have the adequate network access. So these complaints, I guess, for not enough providers of a specific type, it's the complainant's theory that there aren't enough or they're not being able to get in. So I guess where I'm going is then at what point are we checking with compliance? And I'm assuming that because these plans are in compliance that there truly is a network adequacy. They are adequate. The network are adequate. So which leads to my question of how often, I know this isn't something we're tracking, but maybe it's something we could think about a way to do through communication and training, is how many of these complaints could we avoid from the get-go if the consumers were actually contacting their plans and working with their plans? So is that something first? So it could just be a question that if they would have called customer service with the plan would have been able to connect them and see that there really is not a network adequacy issue here. It's just that we're going about this the right way. So, is there any way to kind of track how these complainants, if they've maybe been working with their plans first?
This is David Rogers again. It's a really good question, and maybe something I think in future conversations we can kind of get some guidance on. There's really kind of two schools of thought here. You're right, and a lot of times these can be resolved with the enrollee working directly with the plan. Again, I should mention that these are we capture every complaint register, whether it's validated or not, because we're looking at trends. We want people, to let us know. So on one hand, we kind of like knowing, and we kind of like having the information flow through us because it allows us to look to see if they're, if we don't know what's going on, we don't hear what's going on in this case, from calls coming in, it makes it much more difficult for us to know where to look and to try to figure out if we have, truly have issues and problems that need correcting. On the other hand, one can make an argument that, again, it's really we have health plans and they have member services and that's what they're supposed to do. So there's a little bit of a tension between those two perspectives. I can tell you that we did validate, we have done, it's a good segue into some discussion of compliance. We have done, working with legal services, actions on complaints related to provider directories and inaccurate information, which again kind of shows itself up, may not be truly inadequate networks, but access issues if you don't know who's in the network or you can't get a hold of the people in the network. We are also seeing that as a result of complaints in the dental arena. Right, and particularly in some areas where, again, we do have adequate networks and providers from the reports, but there's some intermediary factor in terms of the information that beneficiaries have available that create complications in getting to those contracted providers. So we kind of like the process. I mean, we like to hear about it because it gives us a good, fairly reasonable handle on what's going on and and what individuals are experiencing.
If I could just follow up, yes, that's why I definitely hesitated to even ask the question, because I know you've always said we want to get this information, and it's the people reporting any kind of issue through the complaint hub is so important. But I do think there is, the more I talk with recipients, that sometimes, or advocates for recipients, that they may not be doing that initial reach out to their plan of, you know, and sometimes they're not even really familiar how to do that. And so this kind of leads up to the changes that I'm sure the MCAC will be talking about over the next year. But the switch, I believe it's going to be maybe March or later in 2017, where recipients are now going to be required to go through the grievance and appeal process with their plans instead of just directly filing a fair hearing. I think that might be a great opportunity for us to kind of really do that education of how important it is to know your plan and be reaching out to your plans for. And then, you can also, of course, be doing the complaint hub, but just really having that initial communication, because they are, it's their medical home. I mean, they should be having that first contact with them, especially they're going to have to do it next year for their fair hearing process.
I think that's right. A couple great setups to transition to compliance, and particularly in light of the new managed care rule and the going through the grievance process prior to fair hearing. Just to kind of set the stage, we have always looked at our approach to compliance for statewide Medicaid managed care as kind of this three-legged stools, right? And one of the legs of the stool is the kind of traditional on-site kind of monitoring visit with the health plans, where you kind of prepare a formal agenda and you kind of prepare in advance, go on site, you know, talk to people, kick the tires, and that's a protocol that's very structured under the federal external quality review regulations. And we do that. We're actually in the process of doing that. Probably about halfway through this year's. Kind of site visits with the plans. We do not find that to be the most effective mechanism for identifying compliance issues. It is helpful in kind of talking about where we're going and working through some issues. So a big focus of this year's visit was really looking at the plan's internal complaints and grievance process, really in preparation for the implementation of the managed care rule, and also to begin to integrate the plan's internal complaint process with our, what we call, you know, the plan reported complaints with our agency received complaints. The data doesn't match up right now, so we don't have the level of granularity in what they're reporting to us, but we're beginning to move in that direction. I think when we get to that point, Amy, then it becomes much easier to redirect to the health plan, because we don't lose sight of the issues. We can still see what's happening out there. So I think it'll take take a while to get there, but as we work in towards implementation of the managed care rule, that certainly was a big focus of our discussion on site with the health plans this year. The second leg to the kind of the compliance stool is the routine reporting done by the health plan. So they report, we were talking about network adequacy, they report contracted providers on a weekly basis. We have a fairly robust automated system that processes that information and kind of does geo-mapping and spits out not only provider ratios, but, time and distance. So we can see by actually measuring the provider locations with all the enrollees' locations, can see what the average travel time is and what the maximum travel time is down at the county level. We have monthly reports and quarterly reports. One of the things that you will see in our compliance effort, hopefully you'll see, I want to speak to that too, is we've been focusing more on the reporting effort and doing a lot of work with the health plans, which I need to kind of to those that are here, thank you, and I know Mary Pat knows this from the association. That has been a significant burden on the health plans in terms of some of the changes that we've undergone through the reporting, right, as we've kind of tweaked those ongoing reports to have a little bit better information that's useful. But you will see more consistently compliance actions that we're taking off of routine reporting. So in the long-term care arena, plans report routinely, I'll never get it right. DRTS, denials, reductions, terminations, and suspensions, and there are certain contractual time frames that they have to provide notice around those things. So we can, now that we've refined the report, we can actually see from the data how plans are doing and if they're meeting those contractual requirements. Grievance and appeals, we've kind of tweaked that, so now we don't get the granularity in terms of the subject matter that we're seeing on the agency receive complaints, but we've got a pretty good fix on the time frame that plans are meeting the contractual time frame for resolution. So you're starting to see more kind of actions taken on that second leg of reporting really to the end of last fiscal year than we have in the past. And then the first leg of the compliance stool by design has been the complaint process, right? I mean, we kind of purposely wanted to try to de-emphasize the once a year, go on site, you know, go through some formal protocol and emphasize compliance based on the real experience of, you know, real life beneficiaries and providers. So, and that happens in two ways. You know, the complaint process is designed to resolve an issue, right? So if that individual, let's go back to the example, is having problems getting a hold of, getting to a dentist, right? Because they can't figure out in the provider directory who's who, or the number that they're trying to call is not, no one's answering, right? The frontline recipient provider job is to get that beneficiary to the dentist, right, and working with the plan to resolve the issue. The plan management compliance overlay to that is to look at whether there are contractual issues, and that can happen. Sometimes happens on a specific case that we'll take action, but more than likely it's when there's those specific cases will trigger some in-depth investigation to look for some kind of trend and some kind of broader systemic issue. And the provider directories are a good example of that, that the individual complaints really triggered more systemic investigation to identify a broader issue. We do not have available for this meeting, unfortunately, but certainly will the next, an analysis of fiscal year 2015-2016 compliance action. So between sanctions, which is kind of our most severe kind of action, and liquidated damages, which we consider non-punitive, but is a noticeable action when a health plan has to write us a check, and then corrective action plans that are not used that often, but sometimes and often used in conjunction with another action. We had, I think, just shy of 100, about 98, I believe, compliance actions for health plans in 2015-2016. So that's about 8 or so a month, probably, on average. We're working on an analysis of that to break that down. The data that we're tracking right now through our enforcement unit, which is actually located in Health Quality Assurance. That's the unit that collects all the fines and penalties from all our regulated entities, so nursing homes, home health agencies, any kind of action taken against licensure. The data that they have is really fairly nondescript, right, because it's based on the contract language. So one of the sanctions that we did, for example, was on a marketing violation. But in looking at the data available, you see a marketing violation, and you can't tell, you know, what that means exactly. Was that distributing marketing material that wasn't approved, or was that going out to an event that had not been reported, you know, in advance to the agency, or was that trying to get a beneficiary to sign up by giving him a turkey? That's if anybody's been around here for 10 or 12 years, that's probably an old reference. We haven't had any of that thus far. We did have had a I think about a half a dozen sanctions, including in the sanctions, it's really not the monetary amount that is most significant. It is the punitive action that's reportable by the health plans. But two of those sanction actions also included freezes of enrollment, one that we did for a plan for provider payment issues in the first quarter of 2000 of the fiscal year, I think back in September. And then one that we did earlier this year in 2016 in terms of some changes to the pharmacy network, the restriction of the network, which is permissible by the MMA plans as long as they maintain the adequacy standards. But we've been keeping a close eye on that, the pharmacy network issue, and we had a plan that went through that transition and quite candidly didn't do it right. And we thought it was a very significant issue, and we froze their enrollment until they could get that straightened out. So we hope to have that analysis done where we get a little bit more granular in terms of what the action was for rather than the contract language, so that it makes some sense. And we hope in working with our enforcement and with some feedback from this committee that we can begin to report on compliance actions in a kind of in a very meaningful way. The other thing that we were doing in the analysis, and we found, again, we weren't even capturing this data in the tracking process, is to identify the source of the action, right? And so I mentioned we're seeing this movement where clearly early part of the fiscal year, the majority of our actions were based on complaints or complaint-driven as a source, and that has kind of moved to a lot more actions being done on the routine reporting. We think that's pretty vital to know kind of where they're coming from. So that's part of our analysis, will be part of our analysis, and also something that we'll begin tracking so that we can tell, even down to the specific report, I think, right, that identifies the compliance issue. So certainly by the next time we meet, we'll have some kind of analysis that probably won't be in the form of a report, per se, as more of an analysis, but we hope to use that to get some feedback that we hope we can launch some type of ongoing report, public reporting on the compliance actions. Okay. And with that, I guess we'll take any other questions.
When will you have your alternate?
When will we
have your owl train?
Oh, when we have the owl train? I don't know. We're checking with Justin. Whenever Justin says, we will have the owl train. That's how it works around here. Does anyone on the phone have any questions?
With that, our meeting is concluded. Our next meeting will be October 18th, and we encourage you to come back and participate. Thank you so much.